everyone, and welcome to episode 7 of the Charity Comms podcast. My name's Robin, and I'm the events officer here at Charity Comms.
And I'm Sishi from Scope.
For this episode, we decided to take a look at why the most important parts of digital aren't always the most exciting or shiny things, but are just as fundamental to your charity's comms.
There's tons of digital noise, so how do you decide what's essential for your charity? And when it's not a brand new app or a shiny chatbot, how can you champion the need for it and achieve buy-in from the rest of your team and senior leadership?
To get some insight on this, we spoke to Emma Delby-Bowler and Gareth John from the digital team at Mind. Their presentation at our Charity Digital Conference back in 2018 discussed how they implemented user personas to improve web content and the experience users had with the website overall. Not a new feature for user-centered comms, but critical for putting your users at the heart of your organisation.
We also chatted to Matt Collins, founder of Platypus Digital, to hear his thoughts on how effective use of digital in charities is down to the hard graft of individuals rather than the tools in front of us. Along with some good old-fashioned myth-busting, he gave us his ideas on how the sector can upskill, become more progressive and efficient.
But first of all, here's our interview with Mind.
Hi, Emma and Gareth, it's lovely to have you with us today.
Hello.
How's it going?
Yeah.
Both great, thanks.
Thanks, Gareth. I am great with answering on my behalf.
Susha's here in the room with us.
So, you guys, you're in the digital team and you're digital professionals. How do you rate Mind's attitude towards digital on a scale of totally digital pros, really up there with all the kind of like, they get it, everyone's on board and everyone's, you know, got everything they need to do to make it wonderful, or way down with the people who think that Windows 10 is being forward facing?
Windows 10 is
forward. Oh, Microsoft boy here.
I think that's an interesting one because I feel like it has really changed over the 2 years since I've just over 2 years that I've been at Mind. So that's about the point that we had a head of digital and actually a digital strategy, and I know that there's like a lot of conversation about whether a digital strategy is the right thing to do or whether it should be a kind of across all other strategies. But I think certainly for the point that we were at in our digital journey, we really did need to have a focus on understanding what we were trying to achieve with digital and how it did underpin everything else, but really pull it out, give it some attention, give it some resource. Mm-hmm. And so that having that digital strategy has really helped us make sure that when we're making decisions, they're coming back to the vision that was agreed by our senior team and sort of getting that buy-in from other teams that digital really is a big part of their roles.
Yes.
And it was definitely in pockets. There were people doing lots of great things, but that idea of digital as underpinning all of your work wasn't really there. And I think that over the last 2 years, a lot of the work that we've been doing has been really internal focused and really making sure that people feel that confidence and understanding of their roles and our roles and actually what the opportunities with digital are. So we're definitely not there yet. I think there's lots of things that we are excited about that are coming up. But really, yeah, the last 2 years, I think we've probably gone from a 4 or 5 to maybe like up to that 7, 8, which, yeah, it's feeling really good.
Oh, fantastic. And you know, what you're saying is actually really common in the sector. You're right that there is this conversation about should you have a digital strategy, should be separate. And actually it's reflective of the idea that it needs to be relevant to your organisation. Mm-hmm. And you present a really good example of where you have to have the ability to get buy-in from the rest of the organisation to be able to pull that resource in, and having a digital strategy might be the tool to get that, which is a really fantastic example of how it has to be specific to your organisation.
I think Emma's completely right. The change over the last couple of years has been pretty phenomenal since Eve took post as head of digital. I found it really interesting in terms of kind of connected to digital, I suppose, is I guess a large part of my role over the last couple of years has been sort of communicate sort of agile methodologies which are tied so closely with digital, and that's been like really, really interesting to see how that kind of interfaces with kind of less agile ways of working. I think it's been good. The other really interesting part, I think, is, and probably not to go into too much depth about this, but working with local Minds as well has been really fascinating. So obviously you've got over 140 organisations with a huge array of different sort of digital skills. Some, you know, are doing stuff that we're kind of not at yet, Some are, you know, some aren't, some will have, you know, a tiny amount of resource. And that's really fascinating to think about how that can work across the network, how we can kind of work together on that.
So, it's probably worth explaining at that point that Local Minds, we're federated, so Local Minds are all independent charities. So although they kind of, it's one of those things that I think we've been so great at getting the brand and getting a consistent identity across all of those minds that people always understand. But yeah, so those charities are run as they think right, and obviously they, you know, we have an agreement with them around their level of service, and they agree to lots of things, and we support them in a number of different ways. But particularly on something like digital, it becomes really clear that there's a different level of engagement and understanding across those different minds, and there's a sort of a different need from them, from us, and that's one of the things that is yet to be cracked.
Cool. So your presentation at the Charity Digital Conference back in 2018 focused largely around how you used personas to improve the content on Mind's website, improving the digital experience of for each persona. So what was the process that led to the decision that this would be the best way to curate and refine your website content and rethink it?
It's a really, really interesting question. So we carried out like a large piece of research at the end of the research, covered like user interviews, analytics. We did it with an organisation called Torchbox, who I mentioned probably familiar with, quite a few charities as well. It's really interesting. In terms of the personas, like, the research really did show us that our understanding of our users was very kind of siloed and quite, I guess, just a little unenlightened. You know, the research told us a lot about our users. The personas that we used, which we talked through, were very much like needs-based as opposed to the kind of standard personas. And I think that made a massive difference as to why they were actually useful. It allowed us to identify sort of what we call the problem space. So mapping for each user, like, okay, so this person, someone in crisis, might be feeling isolated, might be feeling vulnerable. And then, you know, that's kind of worst case at one end, and then the best case at the other end would be, you know, feeling supported and, you know, and feeling part of a community. So how can we, you know, if we map somebody in crisis, say, who's feeling isolated, you know, what kind of stuff can we develop to get them to, you know, that, to get them to a point where they're
feeling isolated. And that was from speaking to people who've been through that and getting that experience.
That's right, yeah. And the personas also included, like, quotes from users, which I think was a really, really valid part as well. So they're really, really helpful in kind of validating sort of hypotheses.
And I think there's also something about different teams having different pots of knowledge that this research has allowed us to bring together. So actually there was really great understanding within our information team, for example, about the experience of somebody in crisis, for example, but us being able to put that in the context of their experiences, in this case on the website, but more generally what their digital experiences needed to be. And the same with fundraising. You know, our fundraising team have a great understanding of, for example, the event participant and what their motivations for fundraising for Mind are, but that was never translated into a way that was consistent across all of these different teams, and that for me has been a big part of it as well.
Well, we just wondered as well, like, it sounds like obviously you guys were talking to your users before this and after this, but it's just the process of how you are utilizing that information to shape the end content. But if you are doing this kind of thing on a shoestring, do you have any advice to people on how they can still reach their users if maybe working with an agency like Torchbox to do this is a little bit out of budget or something? Do you have any advice on how you can still sort of garner that information from the people you're working with and the people that benefit from your services? It's tricky,
So I think one thing, you know, we've talked about the fact that internal teams have a huge wealth of experience and understanding of users. So actually, rather than assuming that that research might not be being done elsewhere or that somebody might not have some insights that you can use, understanding across the organisation what work is being done that can feed into your project is really important. I think asking users, you know, there are low-cost ways you can do it. We ran a SurveyMonkey on our site for a couple of months, I think, to get the
hugely helpful
right number of people. But yeah, sort of, people that are visiting your site are going to be the people that are going to give you some really good insight and some understanding. And don't assume that everything has to be really technical and complicated. Just looking at your Google Analytics and understanding where there's some drop-offs or some sort of, you know, understand where your high volume is or that kind of thing. All of those things you can do the top line of, and just that top line insight is enough to give you maybe the hypotheses to test.
Exactly.
Whatever budget you're on, you're never going to make the right decisions immediately, because that's why we test and iterate.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, from my experience of working when I have in kind of smaller places, there can be a huge advantage to that in terms of your ability to be quite sort of quick to change, you know, like quite easy to iterate in a way that mm-hmm. can be quite harder in a large organisation.
You also mentioned areas of influence in your talk, working out those points where you can just like get that door open a little bit and be like, well, this is how it could be useful. Is that identifying people who are more open to it and get them to sort of sell it in for you? And or how does that really work in practice?
That's a good question.
I think probably a bit of both. So yeah. Identifying the teams that were absolutely vital to the delivery of the project. So understanding what those teams' objectives were, what the current pain points, you know, we talked quite a lot at the start of the project where people were having problems at the moment, and mm-hmm. having that open discussion was really helpful for us, because it wasn't just a digital team are not delivering what we need, but it's a what are the current specific problems that you're having that mean that the website isn't delivering against your team objectives.
Mm-hmm.
And so having those conversations meant that we knew which people were had the most to win, I guess, from the project. And so were most likely to be big supporters if we went to them and sold in how what we were doing was going to solve those problems that they said that they had. So it's that kind of, if somebody's your current biggest critic, then they might be your biggest supporter if you can turn it around for them. And I think that has been really helpful for us.
I mean, I think communication throughout the project has been like hugely beneficial both ways. It's like there are certainly not all stages of the project. There are certainly quite a few stages of the project where like it's just as much feedback as possible, you know, is good, and as much input as possible is good. So those ideas can kind of get fed in and be documented. So I also think just like, yeah, I think if people see your face, especially my opener. If people see your face around, you know.
It's a shame this is a podcast.
Just imagine that. No, it makes a huge difference just to sit and chat with people. And I think that's something which I think it's really important to actually, like, you know, make the effort.
Amazing. Great. Well, just to circle back round to the general theme of the overall episode as well, implementing user journeys isn't like going, look at this great new shiny chatbot we've created, look at this amazing app we're going to implement, but obviously it's just as important. So how can you sell it in or get buy-in from senior leadership as if it was something that was just as exciting? Like maybe if your senior leadership were like, oh, we get it, but it doesn't feel innovative or exciting, how can you really bring them round?
Because they got the money in it.
Yeah. money.
The dollar bills are in their pocket.
It's again, like, it's not a sexy answer to a not very sexy question. Yeah. It's like really grounding on objectives and your strategy, which should lead down to some objectives, and making clear that that's what you're looking to deliver. You know, we really want to be looking at innovation, and it's one of the things that we're really excited about. But for us, innovation isn't necessarily a shiny new thing. Yep. Innovation is helping one team understand how the other team's work will help deliver their objectives, and really sort of making sure that, that we are talking to senior teams about how we're delivering objectives with the not shiny stuff. So celebrating successes. So Gareth talked about the I Need Crisis tool, which was a kind of project that was happening before the website rebuild, but showing that the process that we were going to follow for the website content around user journeys and kind of research-based, you know, which research does take a lot of resource, so we needed to get that senior buy-in, but showing that the research that the team had done around that crisis tool had created a better journey and experience for people that really needed that support. You had a win that you could show and say, you know, we're going to replicate this process across our other work.
I think maybe contrasted with other places I've been before, it didn't feel, I've not felt the same pressure from mind for people to be kind of, not, we haven't had many people kind of just wanting like whistles and bells for no reason.
Right.
I mean, a lot of that's sort of down to the kind of groundwork we do, especially Eve, the head of digital, you know, doing a lot of that kind of communication with other heads of and with senior people to kind of give a little bit more substance to the value of what we're doing.
That is always what you want.
Yeah, exactly.
I want some bells and whistles at some point. We're taking our time to get there.
There's a time and a place for bells and whistles.
Next year.
But the kind of conversation we had with Matt, which kind of links to your episode, is that it's not just, you know, oh, it's just going to pop out of a hat. You know, you've got to do some actual hard graft, like going through those every piece of content to make sure it makes sense, understanding all the bits and elements to that, making sure the UX makes sense and all that stuff. That's proper like work. And
thanks.
And
should talk to my parents.
I know, right?
I'm joking.
So relatable. But
just in case they're listening.
But if you're not on board with that, you know, you can't really operate in this space, because the majority of your work won't be creating a chatbot, creating an app, creating a whizzy tool. It will be doing that kind of like hard graft. Digital marketing is a really good example of this as well. You know, a lot of digital marketing is like really understanding your PPC or your ads or your, you know, whatever tools you use, whatever channels you use, and actually really understanding your channels and your users. So if you're not on board with that stuff, you can't do digital charity sector, yeah. Really.
Cool. Well, we only have one other question. And it's just if you have any advice or tips to charities who are thinking of starting a process like the one you had. So maybe they are making some efforts to try and, you know, get the thoughts from the people they're working with and input that into the website, but they haven't found like a way to do that via personas or something similar. What would you say to charities that are just sort of at the beginning of that process? Any advice?
And also to charities who may have smaller budgets would be quite interesting.
Yes, we do have a lot of people with smaller budgets listening.
Yeah, we know that we're very lucky, but you know, there's always a need. We've not had all of the budget we would have loved to have. But I think the big one for me that I think both Eve and Gareth have done really well is being really clear on what the project isn't delivering. Right. So we are not, as part of the website rebuild, we are not delivering a brand refresh. We're not creating new fundraising personas.
Yeah.
And we're not, you know, answering all of our organisational problems, which I think it definitely at the start felt like people were, it's about the research project, chucking in everything that was, and we need this to be improved. And actually that's, you know, as we talked earlier about different teams, you know, impact on the rebuild, that's also the same thing, is sometimes these aren't problems that we would expect the website to fix. These are things that we need to go away and work on elsewhere, and then bring that insight into the project like this.
Yeah.
So being really clear on that, I think, will help with internal stakeholder management, and also mean that, you know, a project like this, you know resources hard, and time, your people's time is as much as, you know, a problem as the budgets that you have, because a project like this is time intensive. So expecting all of these other things to be done as well is kind of setting yourself up for problems and difficulty and kind of feeling like the project hasn't succeeded, whereas actually, you know, you probably have done a great amount of work, it's just not delivered whatever we expected. Yes, that would be one. And I think, you know, we have talked about it, but stakeholder communication and explaining how the budget or the resource that you're asking for is going to deliver against organisational objectives rather than just you're going to get a shiny new website. You know, that for me is the big thing, because that's where people are willing to invest and where people are hopefully going to be excited by your vision and kind of support you.
Yeah, I think setting aside that time at the beginning of the project and the resource at the beginning of the project to look at users is really, really important. And actually I think it's worth getting confident with kind of why you're doing it. Super easy to lose sight of your users, and ultimately if you get that right and you've got really solid understanding of users, and that's why the personas were so helpful for us, is because it was a really good way of communicating that if you keep hold of that, you know, user need, then a lot of the other challenges become a lot simpler to resolve. And it's really hard, because I think a lot of internal opinion matters hugely, and organizational requirements matter hugely. But you know, they are there alongside user requirements. One thing we did actually with Sigma, following the research, was to define our own internal users as one of our persona groups, which was quite a good thing to do, just in terms of kind of editors and stuff. But it just meant that, you know, if you were developing something, you could say actually this really benefits the people internally as well, because they'll have less to do, or they'll, you know, this would be advantageous for them. Yeah. Documentation is really, really helpful, I think, in terms of being able to give that kind of backstory right back to the users. Internal comms, really, really important, definitely. Working with agencies is an interesting one, and I think, you know, the challenge we've always had, I think, is if you're working with an agency on sort of just development, then often they're not getting a particularly great environment to sort of flex their own skills. Yeah. And it's nice to be able to, you know, what we're doing with Sigma at the moment is we work with them on support and UX, and I think that's excellent, because it means that, you know, they're getting a chance to sort of use their resource in agile ways as well, and you know, it's worked quite nicely. It feels like we're really working as a partnership. You know, whereas it's quite easy, I think, to be like, you know, if you're like reliant on an agency to, you know, to keep the website up, and then you're like, you're sort of shouting at them, whatever, and then like, you know, and then like come Monday, you're like, hey, you know, it's quite nice to just be able to like all work together on it.
Yeah. And one of the things you've just made me think of is making sure a project like this, which requires a lot of resource, is an organisation priority. Mm-hmm. And if it's not, then don't do it yet. Put your time into making sure it is an organisational priority, and maybe do that research piece that shows, you know, where things need to be improved, and again, how they'll deliver against organisational priority, which is, sorry, there should be a bingo card for that one, or a drinking game, organisational objectives. But, you know, if you're not getting that senior buy-in and they're not convinced by this, then it's going to be a horrible project for those people that deliver it.
That's a really good point.
The effort to persuade people before you start on it.
Mm.
Lovely. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on? No? All right, then we will wrap it up there. Thank you so much for coming in. That was so interesting and just wonderful to hear about all the things you're doing to make sure that all your end users, their services are just met. Well, their needs are met. Sorry, their needs are met.
Goals, needs, users.
All my fingers.
Thank you, guys. Okay.
What I really love that came out of our interview with Emma and Gareth is how Mind are really focused on understanding the ins and outs of their users' needs and then weaving that through the foundations of their digital content so that everything they create really serves those needs, but also then matching that with the organisational strategy as well.
Definitely. And I think I really like the fact that they are paying attention to their internal users, because it's so easy to forget about how important they are as a user group. But really, getting it right for them means you'll be able to get it right for your external audiences too.
Absolutely, yeah. They're a really great example of understanding how important it is to lay those foundations. So what does this look like for the rest of the sector? We asked Matt Collins of Platypus Digital to give us his two cents on how the sector interacts with the side of digital that's missing those bells and whistles, from the areas charities are nailing to what's going amiss and how to move forward on those issues.
Hi Matt, it's so great to have you here. It's the first interview we've got back in our original office, so that's great, back where we did some of our first interviews.
Oh yes, the first interview with the snowball mic.
There you go, Susha's here too.
I am here, hello.
So welcome Matt.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, thank you, how are you today?
I'm not too bad, thanks.
Not too bad.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So we thought we'd just kick off with some questions about how you got started in the sector, what kind of path led you to founding Platypus Digital. So tell us about that. Weave us a tale.
Probably this is going back quite far. I was about 11 years old and I was driving the car with my dad. And I think like a lot of people, I was talking about what I should do when I grew up, and he said, well, whatever you do, you should ideally try to make it something that improves people's lives in some way, like even in a little way. Yeah. And I was like, all right, so does what you do improve people's lives? Because he did little bits of radio and like paper reviews, and being a kid, I thought, well, that's obviously what he does all the time. And does that actually improve people's lives, Dad? Yeah. And he managed to, you know, twist the words so that it showed me that it did improve people's lives. And that's definitely the way it should go.
Absolutely.
So from a very early age, I was thinking, yeah, I should definitely do something that blood, sweat and tears is going to go into something. Might as well do some good. And I met a guy at university who I lived with for a year who was a big lefty, fair to say.
Yeah.
And he said he didn't want to do something that just increased the profits for shareholders and helped shareholders buy bigger swimming pools. He wanted to do something that was going to have more impact in the world. And I was really shaped by those two things. So that is what led me to only ever work for charities, which is all I've ever done in my career.
Amazing.
I worked for Childline in Manchester when it was its own charity back in the day. And went through lots of different charities like St. John Ambulance and stuff like that. And set up Platypus Digital 5 years ago now. That's probably a sort of quick version of my story.
Amazing. So was it that you worked in those charities and then you realised there was sort of this gap that you knew that you could create a corporate that could fulfil that need that charities had?
Yeah, there was an awesome meetup called NFP Tweetup quite a few years ago now. And it brought together people who were interested in how digital was changing the sector and how campaigns were being built around this kind of new tool, this new way of doing things. And I met so many inspiring people there who shared so many inspiring ideas. I thought, well, we're on something here. And then my kind of paid roles towards that time lean more towards the digital side of things, building campaigns and having always on recruitment campaigns through social media, things like that. So I started Platypus because I thought, well, digital's the way the things are going, and that's the way that people's lives are changing. And
Absolutely. This
should be something that actually changes people's lives or raises the money to change people's lives.
Amazing.
Cool. And you're the one that said it, so I'm not out of turn by saying this, but you said it was quite a while ago. But you've seen charities grow, change, evolve. And what's some of the things that you've seen change, particularly in when you think about digital, in the charity sector generally?
Well, I think when you talk about change in charity sector in the last, 10, 15 years, say, there's probably kind of three categories of charity that you're really talking about. There's the really big charities, the kind of household names, the sort of top tens, the Oxfam, Save the Children, Shelter, all of that kind of thing. And the trends you've noticed, certainly from the outside, and that is where we see kind of most of the changes, is a much more focused user experience. So if you use the Wayback Machine tool to see what websites look like, that's
always
a fun tool.
I've never done that. I'm obviously out of the loop on that one.
Oh, check it out.
Good.
So look back at the relics of, say, the Shelter website. If you go back to just 2013, it was all sorts of stories. It was a bank of mum and dad. It was, what to do if you've got rotten landlord. And it was that carousel thing where internal teams can't agree on who gets the real estate space on the homepage. And so they all get it by having this rotating image that serves nobody.
Mm.
There's lots of information on the homepage. Now you've got like donate, get involved, find out more. That's it. It's very, very focused on what the user actually wants. So those big charities know that that's the changes they have to make if they're going to have a big impact. Probably the medium sort of size charities, they're still got a digital team of four. They've got a roster of agencies that are either on retainer or come in for project-based work for PPC and campaigns and stuff like that. That hasn't changed a huge amount, I have to say, in the last 10 years. And then the small charities, God love them. Well, they're just being left behind, and they're just as left behind as they were in the beginning, unfortunately, because it all comes down to sort of resources. So I think people can really overestimate the pace of change in that regard. Bill Gates said that people overestimate the pace of change in 2 years and underestimate the pace of change in 10 years. In 2 years, you think everything's going to be different, and it's not really that different. We're still going to be using Facebook. We're still going to be using Twitter and email and stuff. But in 10 years, when he was talking, like just over 10 years ago is when the first iPhone came out, and now everyone's glued to their screens.
Wow.
Everyone, So in 10 years' time, things could be different. So the mobile, obviously, revolution, if you like, has changed things a lot. But mostly that's just mobilized, if you like, a lot of the stuff that was around before, I would say.
I think so.
It's very much dependent on how much money you got as to how much change there's been, if I'm totally honest.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And your audience. Because depending on how it impacts the way you interact with the audience really depends on how they interact with digital themselves.
Absolutely,
which is really varied.
Which varies hugely from age group, the resources they might have. Although these days smartphones are so cheap that probably your audience has some interaction with kind of digital media generally. But yeah, comes down to money, unfortunately.
So what would you say that charities are missing or maybe even ignoring with digital today? And, you know, what are the consequences of the fact that they're missing these things?
The things that charities are missing, it's interesting. I would never lump all charities together.
Yes.
So when I talked about the sort of three categories of charity there, I think you've got to kind of think about that. It's very easy to come in and say charities are behind the digital or charities are doing great with digital. You know, it's just such a broad sweeping statement as to almost be completely meaningless.
So true.
I'd say. So what charity is missing very much depends on the charity. I think most of what a lot of charities, certainly in that kind of medium sized charity, what they're missing, certainly in the small size, is probably a lack of willingness to get their hands dirty and do some of the really boring stuff that actually serves their charitable purposes.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of what we talk about can actually be quite London-centric. So if you think about what charities are like outside of London, so, you know, a charity in Dorset, say, they identify a problem in the community, they rally people around that problem, and some of the online tools you need to do that are, you know, the basics for your big London charities. And they solve that problem, you know, that's how they go about doing things. And in terms of the tricks that they might miss in digital, it's irrelevant. You don't need VR to do something like that. Mm-hmm. You don't need to have a podcast strategy to do something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, you just need to attack the problem that your charity is there to solve. So there's a lot of elements of digital marketing in particular that are really boring to do. And everyone thinks, well, this is going to be shiny. It's going to be the ice bucket challenge, or it's going to be no makeup selfie, and it's going to be super exciting all the time. And what they don't think of it as, for certain specific areas, is a skill. Like, you sit down with PPC, or you sit down with Google Ad Grants, or you sit down in user experience and learn it as a discipline. That's hard work. For a lot of people, it's too boring and they're not interested. They just want to do the shiny things.
Yeah. And that is, I think, what I find most interesting is watching digital teams, digital professionals struggling with this idea of trying to demonstrate their worth, and that worth not looking shiny. And they will be doing hard graft and really good stuff, and they'll be building the foundations, and they'll be saying stuff that, you know, 5 years down the line, someone from maybe someone who's new will come in and say, and they've been thinking, I've been saying this for 5 years, which is really frustrating for them. But it's interesting watching that and seeing them say stuff that actually it is mundane and it is boring and it's not super exciting, but it needs to be done. So you may have seen on the old Twitter last week that Joe Saxton, driver of ideas at NFP Synergy, wrote an article claiming that there is no digital revolution in charities and probably never will be. Do you reckon there's any truth in this?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Definitely there's some truth in it. Wow. Joe makes a number of really, really good points. I imagine a lot of people reacted very badly to it because it's not what they want to hear. It might be a bit demotivating for some people. It's also not as big a problem as people might potentially think it is. So there's a lot of things he's right about. He's totally right about the hand-wringing around the problem of skills in charities. We spend a lot of time going, oh, there's just not enough skills in organisations. You know, it's a real problem for the whole sector, again, without understanding the nuances of charity sizes, of the people who respond to things like that and the people who don't. And, you know, it's not a problem for the charities who are really focused on their work and getting on with building the right tools for the right people at the right times in the right formats. So in terms of the training side of things, obviously skills in the sector it can be a problem, but it does depend on your role. As long as your training is right for the role that you're actually in, then that might be the most important thing rather than the training that you have in all digital marketing skills. The problem with training generally is that, you know, it either has one of these things or two of these things. It's run by experts, so people who are channel agnostic in particular. They're not just pushing their own organization's channels. That it's run by people who actually understand the sector as well. So a really big overlap there. A lot of the training you will see is very commercially driven and sort of customer acquisition focused and so on. So it doesn't have the nuances that charities generally need. It also, I hate to say this, does need to be profit-making. Mm. The reason I say that is that if you go to free training, then you've invested very little beyond the time you've taken to go to that. if you've invested a certain amount of money, research does show that you're much more likely to implement the skills that, you've actually learnt. But along with that, and if you had all of that, and the way, you know, my kind of vision for all of that, if you like, is that there'd be sort of a digital skills academy or a digital marketing skills academy. And it would have, you know, courses and all the main things you need to know about. But it wouldn't just be, hey, you choose your course, you come along and then you leave. There'd be a really strong training needs analysis for your role, what you actually need. And it'd be, you know, channel agnostic experts who would analyze that and not just take your word for it. Because if you go to the doctor and say, doctor, I've got a cold, you know, that's your diagnosis. Sure. But they need to make a diagnosis.
Yes.
They would, you know, give you the right mix of tools for your job. But they would also look at the organizational context that you're going to bring those skills back to. So the mix of skills in your team, the direction of the organization, and if those things aren't right, then you're probably not going to get any value from it. So you shouldn't bother doing it. And beyond that, once they've done all that and you've done your training course in search engine marketing, for example, and then you go back to your desk, how many times have you been to a training course, gone back to your desk and not used it? It's not just down to that person to leave to do everything. What really needs to change when they get back to their desk is that their boss goes, right, this is so important that I need to carve out 25% of your week just to dedicate to this. And it's not that. It's always on top of all the other things that need to be done. And when you get back to your desk and get thrown into a round of meetings and your attention is being pulled left, right and center, you just don't get the chance to do it. So your organization needs to change things fundamentally to allow you to implement the skill if it was important enough to go to. If it's just a day out of the office, go to one of the excellent charity comms conferences and be inspired there. But if it's training that you're looking to genuinely implement, you need time to implement that. And so the your boss and your boss's boss needs to be convinced of the value that that skill will bring to the organization.
And I love the idea that you're diagnosing what needs to happen in an organization for the organization. Because as you say, a person is part of a team, part of an organization that creates a mix that should be able to achieve X, Y, and Z. Such a fantastic idea. When are you launching?
Oh, it's tomorrow. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you can be the first guest. It's a trainee. It's absolutely fine.
So, do you think charities are somewhat fixated on social media? Why is this? And how do you think this is hindering their digital strategy?
Well, yes, in short. Still fixated on social media.
Why are they?
Well, I think the reason charities are fixated on social media, well, a couple of reasons. One is what I mentioned about social media being free in our own lives. And so we think, well, that's where we start because we all know what Facebook is.
Free marketing.
Free marketing. So we start there and so we invest there. And so we just go from what we know and so we invest there. A few years ago, I wrote an article in The Guardian called Charities Need to Stop Wasting Their Time on Social Media. If you just Google that, you'll definitely find it. If you haven't read it already. And I think on the day I responded to 350 tweets from people who were broadly negative about the points I was trying to make. It was a good headline. I think a lot of people read the headline and then responded to the headline. And there was three or four response pieces. Charity Comms ran in a debate on it, which is great fun. I really enjoyed that. And it got a lot of debate going in the sector, I think it's fair to say. And I stand by every word of it, to be honest. Because, well, why are charities still fixed in social media? I think that the charity sector's values are very open, they're very honest, they're sharing, they're about connecting to people, and that's all absolutely brilliant. And that's what social media allows. It allows us to connect with people in a really sort of human way, in a one-to-one interactions online that, you know, may never happen in person. And that's really brilliant. And so we invest in that, I think, because it reflects the values of the sector. But it doesn't really go back again to what the charity is trying to achieve. Typical charity digital teams, maybe like four people. So you might have a head of who often is, you know, busy with a really big website redevelopment project, which is going to take up so much of their time. Very often you'll have a social media officer, often a manager on top of that as well. And I mean, it's a hungry beast, social media. It needs feeding every day. So it's very resource intensive. And so you have to share new stories and you have to do this engagement. But really, if you're trying to reach new people, then Facebook will let you reach maybe 5% of the people who've opted in to hear from you. They'll let you get to 5% of them with their algorithm. Wow. So if you want to reach people, then you can get at least 4 times more by email and get more content out as well. And if you want to reach people, you should be trying to reach them on search marketing generally, because those are the people that want it. Your charity right now has people frantically Googling, sometimes frightened people, lonely people looking to connect. They're looking for that information. And if you don't serve them in those places, then, you know, you can fail them, really. Now, I know social media has a good place, and I know a lot of charities are using it really well. And if you don't use it really well, then it's not so great. And if you're using it really well, brilliant, you know, carry on. I'm not saying everyone should shut down their Facebook pages straight away. But I think that because it's so friendly and because it's so entwined with our personal experiences of digital marketing, it gets more investment than it should.
So digital has largely been considered to fall into the remit of comms, but it impacts every area of a charity. So how can comms teams get people to see digital as part of everyone's job?
Well, first of all, I think everyone would like whatever their discipline is to be part of everyone's job, wouldn't they? Fundraisers say, I think fundraising needs to be part of everyone's job, doesn't it?
Everyone's a fundraiser at the minute.
Yeah, there you go. Finance would say, oh, finance is everyone's job though, isn't it?
It's true. You know? I feel like you're setting me up to tell me that it just can't be done.
Well, I think it can be done, and you just, again, have to question, does that need to happen? So, okay. First of all, does digital need to be part of everyone's job? That, again, is thinking, well, everyone just needs to be a generalist, whether they like it or not. They just need to know about this stuff, and they need to know how to do it.
Yeah.
And if they're being trained on how to do it, and they're not going to do it, because it doesn't actually benefit their job, or there's no time to do it, it doesn't need to be part of their job, and you need to think about the progression of digital generally. It can also be skipping ahead a maturity model before you're ready. So if you think about the centralized model of digital, whereby a centralized team is delivering all of your organization's digital needs and the rest of the organization isn't, the next stage is more hub and spoke, where that central digital team is there for oversight and quality control and training, but other pockets of departments are learning to do it themselves and delivering it to, you know, benefit their own objectives. And then, you know, the nirvana, which nobody has got to, is honeycomb, and everyone's just doing it, and it's just being done to a high standard.
Is it called honeycomb?
It's called honeycomb.
I've not
heard
of that one.
Yeah, have a look. I mean, it's as enticing as it sounds. So if you're trying to make digital part of everyone's job before you've truly established a centralized team that's high performing and delivering great work, but is you know, hampered by capacity, then you're skipping too far ahead. And you don't have the oversight in place. And then people go, well, I don't understand how to use this. And then the centralized team doesn't have the time to show them. And the whole thing falls apart. And you're actually further back than when you started, because people have their faith destroyed in it. So you need to be careful of that, I would say. The other thing you really need to be doing is making sure you're not trying to convince people to do things before they really understand what you're trying to convince them to do.
Right.
So I always try and think of it in terms of the kind of entrepreneurial mantra of help the unaware, inspire the interested, and reassure the intent. So that just means if someone is totally unaware that there's any kind of problem, your job is not to show them how to do Facebook ads for themselves. Mm-hmm. Your job is to show them what the problem is, where the need is, and what the opportunity might be, and then just leave it for a while and then come back and see where they're at with that. And if then they're at the point where they're interested, that's where you don't even then show them what to do and get them to do things. You just need to inspire them. So you need to show them examples of what your organization has done using this particular tool, what other organizations have done using this particular tool, what other corporations have done using this, you know, just inspiring them and showing them what's possible. That's what you need to be doing to get them to the next stage. And then when they're intent, you know, when they're ready to actually make a change and take on these skills for themselves, it's not actually even then that you would tell them what to do. It's that you would reassure them. Because a lot of people will think, well, actually, no, I know I've learned how to do this, but I'm actually a bit, I'm not really sure I should have done, because it's a big change we're talking about here. That's where reassurance is really important. You know, you need to show them, well, we're here to help. We've got, you know, say monthly catch-up sessions to check in how people are using the tool. Don't worry, the director is totally behind all of this and he's going to be talking about it at our next quarterly meetings. You know, just reassuring people that the support is there. And it's actually only then that you should be showing people what to do and how it benefits them.
I think that's very fair in the sense that if you're doing those things in the first place, you are kind of, well, for one thing, you're considering what digital means to your organisation. You're considering who really falls under the umbrella of needing to know that kind of thing. I think a number of people we've spoken to, including, I swear, John Ware when he was at Anthony Nolan, it's like holding, you know, maybe a monthly catch up, or maybe you can do a lunch and learn, and then it's maybe, so it doesn't have to be necessarily going out there and being like, did you know? It's not just me, it's you as well. I can't believe you're sharing responsibility. But
and he said it was very, you know, it was almost like picking how people, where people were, and understanding where people were and adapting to that kind of approach. And he didn't want to give us a definitive answer almost, because he was like, it's very much about the person. So
contextual, which again, almost diagnosing, really.
Yeah, exactly. But before you even try and make digital part of everyone's jobs, you really need to sit and have a proper think about why you're doing that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like there's a bit of an unspoken thing, an unspoken kind of cultural agreements that we're all agree that this needs to be part of everyone's jobs. And it's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. You need to sit and think, why does this need to be part of everyone's jobs? Do they have time to deliver all of this? Are there resources in place for me to oversee this and quality assure it? You know, what's the organisation trying to achieve generally, and why is it not being achieved now? You know, I think we can just jump to the fact it just needs to be part of everyone's jobs, and we'll just agree on that. You need to take a step back and think, why?
I think that's a pretty stone-clad answer. So, we tend to hear time and again from the smaller charities, and to be fair, we may have covered this, so if you feel like you've sort of covered it, that's fair enough, but yeah. Just to pose it again. We do tend to hear from smaller charities that making most things work on a shoestring is a bit of a challenge. And as we've spoken about, sometimes it does just take a good, decent-sized budget to really do that stuff you'd love to achieve. But if it's just not there, how can small charities keep up with the pace of change, if it's even necessary to do that? What does that even mean? And make the most of the opportunities digital has to offer to them?
First of all, I think that the pace of change that we talk about with digital generally is massively overstated.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's this sort of unspoken acceptance in the digital world, if you like, that the pace of change is simply dizzying, and the tools that we're using tomorrow, they're all going to be gone the next day, and then the day after that, there'll be a whole new set, and it's not true. So we were using Facebook 10 years ago, we were using Twitter 10 years ago, do you know, we're still using them. And the new tools that have come up in those times have gone, because they simply didn't have the traction, and they weren't as good ideas as the ones we have now. I think the pace of change is massively overstated. I think what people in small charities should be able to do, and, you know, there should be assistance in doing this, and I think there is some knocking around, is understand what they should use for the resources that they have, just like everyone else. And if they don't have huge resources to do this, then the honest answer is they're going to have to make some really tough decisions about what they prioritise. That's not going to be new to any small charity listening to this. They make tough decisions every day about the work that they're going to do, because they have the same number of hours in the day that everyone else does, but there's far fewer of them delivering that work. So they know how to deploy their resources in the way that has the maximum impact. So again, I would always go back to their charitable objectives first. You know, what local problem potentially is that charity trying to solve? And are there some free tools that can help them do it? And if there's not, well, that's okay. They're a small charity. They don't have the resources to implement a whole new CRM project or pay for a massive advertising campaign. But they do have the resources and the willingness to rally the community around the problem they're trying to solve. You can use Facebook groups to do that. You can use a WhatsApp group to do that. You should use email to do that, because that's going to be free up to the ceiling of people that you probably have to communicate with. You can do that for free. All of that's just going to require a bit of time. And that you should remember that there are, dare I say it, offline ways of delivering some of this stuff. You know, that offline world that we occasionally forget about? You know, where you can just pick up a phone and really inspire someone by just speaking to them on the phone.
But that offline is almost always now complemented with something digital. You know, even when you talk about this offline conversation and offline interactions, you are very likely to match it with the WhatsApp groups and the Facebook group and things like that.
If you can, definitely, but it's a lower quality interaction. Let's face it, you know, if I had 10 people in the room and I was saying, guys, we need to solve this local problem, compared to 10 people on a WhatsApp group or on an email, I'd have them in the same room every time.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's really powerful, and also definitely very true, because I think like there are times where charities are completely the smaller charities are just spreading themselves very thinly, trying to go above and beyond to achieve things. And I think partly it's sometimes because maybe if you go to events like the ones we run, you see these big fantastical things other charities with the budget of Cancer Research UK are achieving, and you're just saying, oh, I could never do that. And sometimes that's a harsh reality to come to terms with. And the challenge is coming away and thinking, but what we are doing is serving its purpose and we're doing it well. And
yeah, and that's what those small charities need to remember, is that they can come away from that and think, oh, wouldn't that be fun to try? And it probably would be fun to try, but there isn't any charity with use digital in its charitable objectives. It's yeah. there to change lives, and that's what you have to be most proud of. If a big charity has got a huge problem and huge resources to tackle that problem, and digital is seen as a great way to do that, then brilliant, then that's what they should do. But if you're a small charity changing the lives of a relatively small number of people locally, you should be damn proud of that. Because whether you're doing that through email, you're doing it face-to-face, or whatever your service happens to be, the important thing is that you're changing those lives, and you should be really proud of that.
And also, ultimately, resources are always relative. So even the big charities will always say that they don't have the resources to meet their needs anyway. And it is because of that relativity thing, you do have to think of it like that. When a small charity is faced with that problem of, I don't have enough money to do this thing, a bigger charity has to feed a bigger beast. So they just don't have the money to do their thing too, even the cancer researchers. So if you had any advice on how to future-proof your digital investments, what would you suggest to charities? What's the thing that they should think about? How do they make sure that their digital investments are as future-proof as possible?
Well, if future-proofing is preventing something going obsolete, then I think we may be seeking more certainty about the future than is actually possible. And again, without going too grand, I think as human beings, we are always looking for certainty in the future. And if you're a fundraiser, you're very used to making projections and revising those projections halfway through your financial year. And you will also be more than aware that a lot of that is, unfortunately, guesswork. And the very concept of projections is trying to create certainty where certainty doesn't always exist. So to say that you can future-proof something, it's like, I know what's, you're basically saying, I know what will happen in the future, and this thing will still be fit for purpose in that time. Now, if you're building something on proven technologies or using proven channels, you have a far greater chance of that being the case. So, you know, if tools have been around for a long time, if you've seen them work in your organization, you've seen them work in other organizations, and you've got the numbers to back that up, and it's a lot of the established channels that you can do that with, then you're going to have a much better chance of doing it. But if you're looking for certainty in the future, that nothing's going to change and that my investment will definitely have been the right one, mm-hmm. then that's very difficult. Yeah. It's very difficult. Depending on what you're looking for, you know, I think the pace of change again is overstated, but, you know, there's a human need to think that the future is all going to work out okay, and I can future-proof certain things, and it's just hard to do. But again, that doesn't mean you should just go blindly into decisions and just go, oh, it doesn't matter, we don't know what the future holds, let's just throw all our money in this new unproven social media network or whatever. But you should accept that you can't future-proof things.
No. Well, I think that's why those meetups, like you're talking about FP Tweetup, and there's so many different meetups these days where people are talking about what their charities are doing, just exchanging ideas. And I think those things help you just have a clearer idea of what's going on, and maybe just give you a bit more of a steer as to what is worth investing in, what's maybe not going to work, and all relative to what you're trying to achieve with it as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important.
And Zoe Amar in her episode talked about the idea that if you're a charity that's got, you know, a slightly bigger charity and you've got a substantial team, you know, your senior leadership team should have a person that's dedicated to horizon scanning. Not that that's their full job, but they have that in their kind of remit, that they know that they should be seeking the next opportunities. They should be working out what would be the right investment for the charity, so that they can feed that back into the charity and you can make informed decisions as possible.
Yeah, I mean, most charities are operating in these silos because they're very focused on solving the problems that they were created to solve. And that can lead to, you know, blinkered thinking and not having enough attention on even what's coming up in the next quarter, never mind the next few years. You can only ever get educational sort of guidance on what's coming up in the future from horizon scanning, for sure. But, you know, planning is a big issue generally in charities. You know, briefs can come in very late and directions can be changed at a moment's notice. And so that's a sort of broader problem in terms of planning. But yeah, you should be looking outside your organisation as much as possible. And it's up to us to create the networks that make that possible and not thinking that everyone has to do everything. You know, you don't have to. You need to do the things that work for you.
Definitely. Well, that is about what we've got for you today, so we'll wrap it up there. Thanks so much for coming in. It has been very enlightening and it's been a total pleasure to chat to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
I really like how Matt called me on using the sort of the phrase pace of change, because really his stance on that encapsulates his stance on how the charity deals with digital generally, in the sense of you've got to be constantly connecting it back to what your users actually need, how your organisation works, how you interact with those people you're supporting, and therefore what is most useful to them. And, you know, getting caught up in what seems like is the next thing that you need, or the next thing that every charity seems to be jumping onto, because that is the most innovative thing that you could be doing at this time. And therefore, it might feel like it's the best thing you can do for your users, but really, when you consider how it's really going to feed back into your organisational goals or into the way that you work on the ground, it might be completely irrelevant.
Definitely. I really liked his idea of creating digital marketing academies. Just the idea that you would really embrace learning and understanding how something can work for your organisation. And actually being quite honest about the fact that we, as a sector, aren't, you know, as skilled sometimes. You know, we do have a lot of skill in the sector, but we sometimes are, you know, when unable to support people to develop. So I think anything that could basically raise the level of skill across the board for people for their very specific needs is really exciting. Hope it does it.
Yeah. We'll be first to put our names down, Matt. Great. Well, that's it for this episode, and this is actually the last episode from Sushi and I, as I'll be leaving Charity Comms at the end of April. I'm heading to the Health Foundation, so I'll still be a member of Charity Comms, and I might still cross paths with you all at an event, hopefully. To everyone who took part as a guest, helped us check the sound levels, gave us the space to record when the office had a blackout, or any kind of support, we just want to say a massive thank you for that.
Yep, and we're handing over the baton to the Charity Comms team, and the podcast will be on a short break while this transition takes place, so please bear with them.
Yes, watch this space. Thank you so much for listening. It has been a real pleasure creating these episodes for you and having the opportunity to speak to the wonderful people who've been featured. Bye for now.
Bye for now.